I was on a return flight from Jerusalem. It was a Saturday, and I was due to preach this very passage the next day. And I got talking, as you do, to the person next to me on the flight, a lady, a young Jewish woman. And I said to her, "Oh, I'm actually speaking from your scriptures tomorrow, in fact. From, I might not know much about it, but from the book of Judges, if you're familiar with that." "Oh, yes," she said. What part are you speaking of?" I said, "Well, actually, it's a very unusual section. It's about this woman who drives a peg through the head of this bloke in a tent." I said, "Oh, yes, Yael, that's my name." "Right. Remind me not to sleep on the plane then." "Hello." That was remarkable. She wasn't very familiar with the story in context of the bigger picture, and you may not be very familiar with it beyond what we have just read. But this is introducing us to a skull crusher who defeats the enemy. And the theme that I want us to consider is simply rejoice in the skull crushing Savior. That's the big picture. And the opening verse sets the scene for us in chapter 5, verse 1. Chapter 4, verse 1. "After Ehud died, the Israelites once again did evil in the eyes of the Lord." So the scene is set with the same old habits, this monotony that happens right through the book of Judges that you will have already seen if you've been here with Peter. It's repeated. Yes, they do it again. Yes, that's sad and foolish. Yes, it's very predictable and uninventive. And it's meant to draw a reaction out in us and in you to want to move away from that unrewarding, self-destructive behavior. Well, we do find ourselves, don't we, falling into the same habits again and again, the same destructive behaviors, the same sinful patterns. And the purpose as we read that is, on the one hand, to take hope that we're not the only ones, but also to drive us away from that monotonous behavior to the Lord himself, who brings deliverance and victory in unexpected and undeserved ways. But first, the people need to see their need, and we all need to first see our need of rescue. And so, in verses 2 to 3, "So the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, a king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Because he had 900 chariots and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, they cried to the Lord for help." So, we now meet two key male characters. They're the bad guys, basically. You've King Jabin, the Canaanite king, we're told, and the commander of his army, who's named Sisera. And Sisera will be the one the plot focuses on, so keep him in your mind. And they come from Hazor. That's a place that had been defeated in the past by one of the other leaders named Joshua. But they had kind of regrouped, and now they were in a position of real political and military strength, as exemplified there in verse 3 by the fact that they had 900 chariots, which is a way of saying basically they were the number one armored division in the whole region, and you didn't want to mess with them. And they were cruel, and they were oppressive. They cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, verse 3, and they shut down the daily life of the people. So if you look across at chapter 5, verse 6, it says, "In the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Yael, the roads were abandoned. Travelers took the winding paths. Village life in Israel ceased until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel." So the joys of everyday life had ground to a halt, and it's ironic that when the people turn away from God in search of freedom, they only find slavery, which is an irony that we all are confronted with. You look for freedom elsewhere, you find only slavery away from the Lord. And then, even though it's taken 20 years to come to their senses, to cry out to the Lord, they do, and we meet the first of our female lead characters, Deborah, in verse 4. Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at that time. We're told she's a prophetess, which means she speaks the word of the Lord, immensely significant because this is one mess of an era. She's a wife, she's a judge, she's one high-capacity individual who can get an awful lot done. And she has presence. She's a woman, as we'll see, of clear conviction, initiative, and godliness. And she's a ray of light and hope in this dark time. And she does have something of that more familiar judge role. You see, verse 5, she held court under the palm of Deborah. And the Israelites came to her to have their disputes decided. So she does have that role, but she is going to be the one who actually initiates the end of this period of such cruelty under the Canaanites. So, verse 6. She sends for Barak, son of Abinoam's, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and says to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun, and lead the way to Mount Tabor. I will lure Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots, from his 900 of them, and his troops to the Kishon River, and give him into your hands." So she says, here's the plan, right? She says, here's what we're going to do. Get the troops together. Here's the pin on Google Maps, Mount Tamar. You can't miss it. It's right out in the open. And yes, all of these enemy guys are going to think that you're sitting ducks. That's the idea. Here's the deal. The Lord himself is going to lure Sisera and all his shiny 900 chariots to their doom. All right, if you got that, sentence. That's the plan. An amazing response from the Lord. This complete plan of attack in place, victory assured, time to end the oppression, 20 years later of misery, bang, right, here we go. You'd think Barak would say, excellent, show me the way, I'm in. Look what he says in verse 8. Barak said to her, if you go with me, I'll go, but if you don't go with me, I won't go. What is he? Is he like one of us? Is he like when you go out and you say, oh, I don't want to go over, I don't want to go on my own, you come with me, I don't want to be sad and lonely, who will I talk to? But that's what he sounds like. It's kind of pathetic. Not exactly a heroic response. It's very weak. But more than that, he puts conditions on obedience. He's not taking God at his word. I'll obey if. He's been given a word from the Lord by Deborah. And he's saying, well, if. I'll obey if. Obedience on his terms and his preferences. And we can be like that ourselves. Selective. I'll obey if. But it doesn't work like that. God is remarkably patient with us when we don't listen and when we react poorly and even cowardly to his word. But what this chapter will show is that doesn't make it admirable or excusable. And while we won't lose out on our place in God's great plan of salvation, we may very well lose out on further blessing and maturity along the way. And when you look back on your life, let me guarantee you that you will never regret obedience. It'll be the well if, but you'll never regret obedience. Now, even if Barak was meaning he wanted the assurance of the Lord to be with him through Deborah, his response from her isn't met with any particular admiration. These men are not stepping up, and it's a sign of the spiritual weakness going on in the culture. Verse 9, Deborah says, very well, I will go with you, but because of the way you're going about this, the honor will not be yours, for the Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman. His conditional obedience is going to limit his glory, the glory that he enjoys. She tells him that plainly. The mighty Sisera is going to go down 20 years later, but Barak will not be the one to take him down. Someone else will. A woman will, in fact. Now, you'd think that obviously was Deborah. But this plot is full of twists and turns, and we wait to see just what will happen. So, verse 10, battle lines are drawn. So Deborah went with Barak to Kadesh, where he summoned Zebulun and Naphtali. 10,000 men followed him, and Deborah also went with him. Now Heber the Canaanite had left the other Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law, and pitched his tent by the great tree in Zanamim near Kadesh. Now, why does verse 11 follow verse 10? We seem like we're just getting in on the action, and then we've got this kind of odd, weird move away from the big picture scene. It's like an interruption in the story, and it is an interruption in the story. It's like an almost not fitting detail, and it is an almost not fitting detail. And it has a lot got to do with what is going to come. So the reader just wants you to log that for now, and we move back out again into the big picture. And we'll come back to why that diversion was significant. Now, verse 13. Sisera gathered together his 900 iron chariots, so we know for sure he's got 900, we've been told many times now, and all the men with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the Kishon River. He comes out in full force, basically, brings everything he's got, right down to the last chariot and the last man. It must have been an absolutely terrifying sight. And verse 14, then Deborah said to Barak, go, this is the day. This is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you? So Barak went down Mount Tabor, followed by 10,000 men. At Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera, just as he said, and all his chariots and army by the sword. And Sisera abandoned his chariot and fled on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. All the troops of Sisera fell by the sword. Not a man was left. So Deborah has no fear, and she is the one who directs Barak to the charge, and the enemy seems to just melt away. The Lord keeps his word and crushes the enemy right down to the last chariot and the last man standing, verse 15, on foot, Sisera. Now we get a lot more poetic detail of how the Lord defeats the enemy if you look across to chapter 5 again. And verse 20, we read, from the heavens the stars fought from their courses. They fought against Sisera. The river Kishon swept them away, the age-old river. The river Kishon, march on, my soul. Be strong. Then thundered the horse's hooves, galloping, galloping. Go his mighty steeds. Now remember in verse 13 that Sisera had gathered at the Kishon River. The Lord lured him there and used the river to sweep them all away, like he had done to the chariots of Egypt back in the day. And they were defenseless against it. And so Barak hunts them down, but the Lord is the one who is bringing deliverance in this story. The Lord is the one who is delivering, and that is always the case. And that's where this story emphasizes things. It's his victory. It's his strength that we rejoice in. It keeps us from despair when human leadership is weak and it fails. And it keeps us from pride when we think that we're somehow fighting our own battles. And after this sweeping, large-scale battle is over so fast, we are just left with one man in our sights, verse 17. One man on the run, Sisera, on foot. So he gone from 900 chariots to running on foot. He has nothing. Not even one of his chariots available to him. So he's exposed now, verse 17. He's vulnerable. And it's just like, you know, when you see these scenes unfold in the movies where there's this one dude who's left kind of running along in the distance, and you say to yourself, he's dead. They're going to get him. He's never going to live through this. And look where he goes. Look where he goes. He fled on foot to the tent of Yael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite, because they were friendly relations between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the clan of Heber, the Kenite. Now here's the connection with that little long verse in verse 11. This seemingly random man, Heber, had struck a deal of some kind with King Jabin, and so Sisera heads there, thinking, these guys, we've got a pact. That's my safe haven. I'm going to head there. And now we meet the second female lead, Yael. I had never met a real-life Yael in my life till I was on that plane in Jerusalem. Nor did I know that it's not Jael until she pronounced it Yael at the time, which makes sense because it's a Hebrew name. She was a formidable character, I must say, who knew her mind. And this Yael is one who knows her mind and takes the initiative. Verse 18. She went out to meet Sisera and said to him, come, my lord, come right in. Don't be afraid. So he entered her tent and put a covering over him. Now this is a break with traditional hospitality custom here, but Sisera is exhausted and he's desperate. And he just senses something's up. Come on in. There's nothing to be afraid of. You know, not anybody ever says that to you. You kind of think, it probably is, if you're saying that. He doesn't suspect anything, though. He comes in, and Yael makes him comfortable for now. Verse 19, I'm thirsty. Please give me some water. Water? I'll do one better. I'll give you milk. And she looks after him. She opens a skin of milk. She gives him a drink, and she covers him up again. And that probably wasn't just like a milk that we would think. It's likely would have been something like a rich yogurt type of thing that would have brought him some welcome refreshment after all the exhaustion of running around and all the trauma of what he's just been through. Little does he know that it's going to be his last meal on death row. So she kind of tucks him in. You notice that, how she does that? She covers him, kind of tucks him in to help him relax like a baby or in her care. And then Sisera, who's used to giving orders, he starts telling her what to do, to stand like a bouncer on her own doorway as his last line of defense, verse 20. If someone comes by and asks you, is anyone here? Say, no. But Yael, verse 21, Heber's wife, picked up a tent peg and a hammer and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. She drove the peg through his temple into the ground, and he died. This is why I was thinking myself, I'm glad I don't sleep on airplanes. Somebody with this namesake next to me. It's just categorical. Bang, bang, bang. In verse 22, Barak then arrives on the scene in pursuit of Sisera. And Yael went out to meet him. Come, she said, I will show you the man you're looking for. So he went in with her, and there lay Sisera, and again the detail, with the tent peg through his temple, dead. So Barak slightly comically re-enters the scene. He seems to be chasing the very glory that Deborah had told him that he wouldn't be given, that a woman would have it. And now we see who that woman is. It's Yael. And she brings him into the tent to say, look, see for yourself, there he is. He's not going anywhere. And again, we're told Sisera is dead. It wasn't what Barak was expecting to see. Yael humiliates Sisera in a dishonorable death, and she humbles Barak by depriving him of the glory of defeating this cruel and enduring enemy that had oppressed the people for 20 years. And we're not told what motivated Yael. Chapter 4 just tells you what she did. This is how it happened. And I've entitled this talk, Rejoice in the Victory of the Skull-Crushing Savior, which I acknowledge, seems like a very unsavory thing to encourage anybody to do, right? Surely we cannot rejoice in the cold-blooded murder of Sisera and the brutal nature of his demise. How can we rejoice in how she subdued this man and killed him in such a calculated way? I mean, would you name your daughter after this woman? Well, look at verse 23. On that day, God subdued Jabin, the Canaanite king, before the Israelites. The hand of the Israelites grew stronger and stronger. Deborah had her role, so did Barak, so did the 10,000 troops, so did the skull-crushing Yael. But who are we told after all of that subdued? Who brought about the victory? Who won over the enemy? It was God. God did. God did that. God is the skull-crushing savior after all. He is the key character in this deliverance drama, and his deliverance is to be rejoiced in and celebrated. And where chapter 4 is descriptive and says what happens and does it dramatically and methodically, but it doesn't interpret it for you in the way chapter 5 does. And chapter 5 is a song. Chapter 5 is a sung duet with Deborah and Barak. And this song tells us how to interpret these events. Yael's not another villain. She's, in fact, a deliverer, a very unlikely one, but one to rejoice in. Look, verse 24 of chapter 5. Most blessed of women be Yael. Most blessed of tent-dwelling women. And then the whole gruesome event is put to song and celebrated in all its skull-crushing gore. He asked for water and she gave him milk. In a bowl fit for nobles, she brought him curdled milk. Her hand reached for the tent peg, her right hand for the workman's hammer. She struck him, she crushed his head, she shattered and pierced his temple. At her feet he sank, he fell, there he lay. At her feet he sank, he fell, where he sank, there he fell, dead. Did you get that he's dead? Verse 31 of chapter 5. So may all your enemies perish, O Lord, but may they who love you be like the sun when it rises in its strength. Then the land had peace for 40 years. If he's dead, the oppression is over. Liberty has been won. Freedom has been secured for God's people because God has won. And the right response is to sing and rejoice. The whole incident with Yael is so precise, so particular, so detailed. Right down to the hammer and peg. One enemy, one skull, one peg. Particular, effective, complete deliverance. That is significant. It rings another bell to the reader of the scriptures. Back in Genesis 3, right after the sorry affair of Adam and Eve chose the hollow promise of disobedience, God speaks to Satan. He curses Satan and for how he deceived Adam and Eve. And what does he say? He says, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. And isn't that revealing? We are meant, therefore, to expect a skull crusher to bring deliverance and defeat the enemy of sin and Satan. We are meant, therefore, right after Genesis 3, to anticipate that, to seek that, to long for that, and to rejoice in it when it does occur, and occur in the most unexpected of ways. So it's no accident that Yael did what she did. God is in control from the expanse of the galaxies to a single hammer and ten peg. He is particular in what he does. And Yael gives us a taster of Genesis 3 and of greater things to come. She takes Sisera out of the world, but she cannot take sin out of it. She strikes a decisive blow against Jabin, but she cannot stop Satan rising up again and again to oppose God's people. But she does remind us that God has not forgotten his word and his intention to crush Satan's head decisively. It rings a bell in the mind and points forward to the ultimate skull crusher, the one male character in the Bible who never falters and who gives an unconditional obedience to the Father and consequently never loses a shred of the glory due to him. God was in control with the hammer and the tent peg, and he was in control with the hammer and the nails of the cross of Jesus Christ. Judas betrayed him, the Jews accused him and demanded his death, Pilate condemned him and handed him over to be crucified. The soldiers raised the hammer and nailed him to the cross till dead, dead, dead. But whose was the victory? The Romans had not subdued him. The Jews had not subdued him. Satan had not subdued him. They did not win the day. On that day, the Lord subdued sin and Satan. On that day, the Lord won the great deliverance. On that day, the promised skull crusher prevailed. It was the most unexpected of victories demonstrated in the resurrection. It was the most precise event in the history of the world. And all the characters served to do was what the Lord had decided beforehand would happen. The triumph over sin and Satan. And in the cross, Jesus disarms the enemy. He humiliates the enemy. He makes a public spectacle of the enemy. He triumphs over them by the cross. And we rejoice in the deliverance he brings because he took everything that stood against his people. Everything stood against you. Everything Satan would use to accuse you, he canceled it. It was nailed to the cross, precisely, effectively, perfectly. He was the skull-crushing Savior, the most unexpected of Saviors and the most unexpected of deliverance. His enemies thought him defeated, but in fact, the commander-in-chief of all evil and oppression was crushed, skull-crushed, defeated. On that day, God subdued the enemy and secured all of the glory. And with the sin-smashing victory of the cross, he secures an eternal rest for the land of the new heaven and the new earth, the home of righteousness, where all glory will go to him. The brutality and unfamiliarity of this account with Yael is a sobering reminder of the brutality of the cross, which we so easily sanitize with our familiarity. Its brutality is also its glory and our freedom. The Psalm of chapter 5 tells us how to rejoice in our deliverance. The cross is repeatedly and specifically referenced in the New Testament in tones of rejoicing gladness. And it is a victory to rejoice in and celebrate because it secures our freedom. It secures our freedom from the enemy, from his deceitfulness, from our own willful choosing of all that is false over all that is true, from the tyranny of sin, from death and hell, all crushed for those who entrust themselves to Christ. Satan's head is crushed. His power over us is broken by the cross. And when Jesus returns, he will finally hurl that defeated enemy into the lake of fire and ever to rise again. It took 20 years for the people in this instance to come to their senses and cry out to the Lord. How long will it take for you to realize the ruin of your sin in your life and your need of rescue, liberty, and freedom? Don't get Jesus wrong. He doesn't want your pity. He demands your allegiance because he is the skull-crushing Savior to rejoice in. And so went my chat with the AL on the plane. I said it's about liberty, that story. It's about freedom. It's about forgiveness. It's about joy. It's about deliverance. It's good news. What an aim to have. I trust she left thinking about the skull-crushing Savior, and I commend him to you and to rejoice in him. He is the skull-crushing Savior. Rejoice in him.